And we've conducted, in the last 2 years, extensive research around the world to see what the gaps are as it relates to this global epidemic that we know as cancer. What we learned is both heartbreaking and unjust. Many suffer in silence due to the stigma associated with this disease and also the myths and misperceptions that are all too prevalent and universal. We saw a woman in Mexico with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma whose husband was moved to tears when he talked about the isolation that his wife now faces at a time when she's in the fight of her life. We sat with a young man in India who fights his disease alone in his bedroom, never being told of his exact diagnosis, and sent home summarily to die. Leveraging our recent successes and partnerships here in the United States, it's now time to take this fight and make cancer a global priority among NGOs, individuals, and world leaders. We seek to build upon the recent pronouncements from WHO, the International Union Against Cancer, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the American Cancer Society, and others so that we can ultimately reduce the global burden of this disease. And we call upon everyone here and everyone around the world to sign the World Declaration on Cancer, and you can do that at our website at livestrong.org. We also call upon world leaders to lay out a strategy for their own country as to how they will combat this disease moving forward. Working together, we can make tremendous progress. And ultimately, we call on people around the world who have been personally affected by cancer to share their stories in an effort to ultimately reduce the stigma of this illness. Before I introduce our first guest who will make brief remarks, I want to just tell you that when I was a young child, my parents taught me one very important thing, and that was the singular difference between a community and a crowd. And the difference is very simple. And that is, in a crowd, people push and shove and elbow and try and get ahead of one another. And in a community, people look around and they realize that ultimately no one will get ahead unless everybody gets ahead. Our first speaker is John Ceferin, a close friend, the president and CEO of the American Cancer Society, former head of the International Union Against Cancer. And John knows that as a community working together, we can eradicate this disease and this illness in our lifetime. Ladies and gentlemen, John Ceferin.
Thank you, Doug. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We at the American Cancer Society could not be more pleased to have this opportunity to join you today, and I would like to personally thank Lance Armstrong, Doug Ullman, the tremendous staff and volunteers at the Lance Armstrong Foundation for their commitment to expand and accelerate their global efforts. Ladies and gentlemen, cancer potentially is the most preventable and the most curable of the major life-threatening diseases facing humankind, and yet, if we don't intervene, it will become the leading cause of death from all causes by 2010. I would also like to thank President Clinton and the Clinton Global Initiative for this unprecedented commitment and collaboration on global cancer control. Cancer kills each year more people than HIV, AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria combined. I'm inspired by President Clinton's vision of global citizenship and grateful for his recognition of cancer as a universal threat to health, prosperity, and yes, indeed, freedom around the world. And many thanks, too, to Mayor Michael Bloomberg for his bold stand to protect people not just in New York or America, but all around the world to the effects of tobacco smoke. We know that tobacco smoke causes one in every three cancer deaths per year. Well, you know, it was here in New York City in 1913 that the organization I'm privileged to head up, called the American Cancer Society, was founded as the first NGO of its kind. And for 95 years, we've not only worked in the United States but around the world to help build cancer leagues, to help build civil society, to do something about the problem of cancer. Indeed, we are now operating some 20 programs in 20 different countries, so you can appreciate how proud we are to be able to be supportive of and to cooperate with the Lance Armstrong Foundation and their tremendous, exciting work. As Lance Armstrong has noted, many low- and middle-income nations face huge hurdles to fight this disease that knows no geographic, social, or economic borders. Among the biggest hurdles is the stigma of cancer. In many nations, cancer is only discussed in hushed tones, as it was in our own nation of the United States early in the last century. And too many people consider cancer to be a certain death sentence, which it too often is, but need not be. They are not aware that cancer is often preventable. 60% of all human cancer is preventable. If we only do what we know needs to be done, we can prevent 60% of all cancer during a normal human lifespan. And clearly, when detected early, it's now one of the most treatable and indeed curable diseases. Tragically, people feel alone and sometimes just resigned to accept it as a death sentence. And by the way, the treatment of end-stage disease is also important. For all intents and purposes, in most of the rest of the world, there is no such thing as cancer palliation or pain relief. Last year, 89% of all of the controlled pain-relieving medications, including opioids, 89% were consumed in North America and Europe, which effectively means the rest of the world is written off with simple analgesics, which are cheap and readily available if systems exist to allow people access to them. Well, I'm proud that we can work with the Lance Armstrong Foundation, because when I, as a former president of the International Union Against Cancer, tried hard to get countries to work together and to elevate cancer on the agenda, we made a little progress, but we really didn't succeed. But I think we will succeed, as I told Doug Allman, because now we have someone not just of fame and public recognition and high credibility and a cancer survivor, but we have someone who's willing to put skin in the game every day. It's not rhetoric anymore. It's about doing something about the cancer problem globally. And he knows, Lance Armstrong knows, that by reentering as a competitive cyclist and talking about the cancer problem around the world, it'll give it the visibility it deserves. Because we know cancer affects societies on every continent, we must envision a global cancer awareness that transcends language, culture, and certainly politics. Cancer is the world's problem today, and it will take a global world leader's effort, small communities, and people in the highest offices of government to win the fight that has gotten a significant boost here today. Thank you very much.
Our next speaker clearly needs no introduction, but let me just say this. Almost exactly 11 years ago, after battling cancer myself three times and entering the nonprofit cancer community, I got an email from someone I'd never heard of, who participated in a sport I didn't follow, who lived in a state I'd never been to, and that was Lance Armstrong. And that email said, at the end, we are the lucky ones. Let's find a way to work together and try and change the world. And 11 years later, it's an honor for me, on behalf of our board of directors and our incredible staff back in Austin, Texas, to stand here and say that we truly are on the verge of changing the world and the health of this world forever. Lance Armstrong.
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for being here. Thank you for making this press event bigger than the first comeback in 1998, because there was about five of you here for that one. As you all know now, I have decided to return to professional cycling for several of the reasons that we laid out at CGI, if you were fortunate enough to be there. And not to repeat what Dr. Seffran said, but we really are facing a global health epidemic here, and I sat back with the team, with Doug, the rest of the team at the foundation, and after 2 years of studying an international strategy in select countries all over the world, not just in Europe and not just in Asia, but all over, coupled with a small mountain bike race in Colorado that reminded me that I truly love to ride a bike for long hours every day, those two things came together and said that perhaps I should get back on the bike in order to implement this strategy. That's my first and foremost priority here. I think there will be a lot of questions later on about the tour. Can I be successful? Will I be successful? What is at stake? Why come back, et cetera? Try to answer those when I can. I would just remind you and repeat that that carrying this Live Strong message around the world, whether it be on a bicycle or through the media, is the number one goal. And I think that we have a great team in place to do that. We have a willing time in our society and in other societies that are waiting for this message. I look forward to that. A couple of details for you guys and gals. I will race in 2009 with Astana, reuniting myself with Johan Bruneel. While we looked at other teams and we talked with other teams, as a friend and as a longtime partner and as somebody that really trusts Johan on every little decision of the program, I could not ever imagine racing against him or racing without him. So Johan and I will once again be together in 2009. My first race will be in Australia at the Tour Down Under. The only three races that I can tell you I'm doing for sure are the Tour Down Under, the Tour de France, and the Leadville 100. But they don't know that yet, so don't tell them. What am I missing? A couple of people behind me that I think make this this story a little more interesting. Who's in the middle here, a young man by the name of Taylor Finney, who is the son of Connie and Davis, old friends of mine. I actually raced with Davis for many years when I first started racing here in the States. Taylor is the future of American cycling. And with this, we not only did we want to have the Livestrong Global Campaign, we wanted to have a development component, and I feel like by building this team around Taylor, having Axel Merckx direct the team, this is what our sport needs. I think it's one thing to have a professional team and try to win big events. But I know the perspective as a bike shop owner. I know the perspective as somebody who owns different pieces of the industry. And I think it's critical that we develop the young cyclists of the United States. And clearly, Taylor is the best and the brightest. Just turned 18 years old. Was 7th or 8th at the Olympics?
7th.
7, 8, I don't know the difference. it was an important piece of the equation. To his right is a gentleman by the name of Don Catlin. When I began to think about coming back, I knew that, because there had been questions in the past, many of which we considered to be unfounded, I knew that there would be questions about performance, like there is questions about all kinds of performance. If it's a 100-meter dash at the Olympic Games or if it's the 100-meter freestyle at the Olympic Games, people will question good performances, and I don't know that I can perform well. But in the off chance that I do perform well, I didn't want to leave any doubt. And so I reached out to Don and asked him to oversee this program, to be completely independent, completely removed from me, to do whatever he asked me. I would do whatever he asked me to do. I think it's a landmark program. I think it's the first time where an athlete can actually be totally validated in the chance that he's successful. And in my opinion, Don Catlin is beyond reproach. He is one of the foremost researchers in the anti-doping movement. His CV is a mile long, and I don't need to try to repeat it. But I have told Don, and I told him last night, and I'll continue to tell him this. Don, I have myself, I have my bicycle, and I have my cause. You come whenever and however you want to come in order to validate these performances. And I felt like that was an important part of this equation as well. So to summarize, you have the Livestrong campaign, you have the development team with Taylor and other riders and Axel Merckx, and then on the anti-doping front, the Don Catlin component. So be happy to answer any questions, and I know that these guys will as well. George?
I can understand an athlete wanting to come back. I've seen it. They want to try to come back. I can also understand what you accomplished with your foundation by getting cancer. I'm not clear about the link. How can you be valuable when you're out training in, you know, Spain or Australia or wherever you'll be, as opposed to fighting service?
I'm sorry, the last part, fighting cancer. In a suit. Well, it's a good question. I think you can be successful doing both things, and I will tell you that while I'm out training and racing all over the world, many times, unfortunately, I'll still be wearing suits. I think it's undeniable that an athlete in his prime or near his prime or competing close to the highest level can have more of an impact than a retired athlete. Wherever we choose to go, if it is Australia, if it's South America, if it's South Africa, they will come with some conditions. Obviously, the program or the race and the itinerary has to fit into the entire program of trying to prepare for the tour. But I don't think that we would go somewhere if they weren't actively involved and actively engaged in trying to make a difference in their country or in their region or in their society with regards to this disease. It could be a lot of different things. In Africa, it could be vaccinations for young women. In Asia, it could be smoke-free society. It could be tobacco control. In Australia, it could be increasing the budget at the Australian Cancer Institute or certainly continuing the great work that they do on melanoma. These all have to be part of the program, and I might be wrong, but I think that me being on the bike and me competing professionally increases the pressure and increases the likelihood that we'll be able to make progress in these different countries.
I have a question about the screening program, and I don't know if you were planning to give more details about it later, but I'm also interested in who's funding that specific screening program for you. Mm-hmm.
I've asked the team to fund that program. Obviously, Don is passionate about what he does. Don is not free. Don works as well. But I think the important thing to know is that, I think I overheard Don say the other day that there's not enough money anywhere to potentially buy out Don Catlin. So for the conspiracy theorists out there that might think that, I would refer them to Don Catlin. But the team will underwrite that. And again, the important thing to note is his reputation, his credibility. He's devoted his life to this work. There isn't enough incentive for him. And lastly, as I said again, I'll repeat it, I've made myself completely available, not just to Don, but to everybody. So with Don... tests or comes up with, or however the profile shows, it will all appear online for everybody to see. So you guys can all analyze it and look for slight differences yourself. And I think most importantly, it'll be an educational process for the sporting public and the sporting press to understand that with high level endurance sport, you do have fluctuations in certain things, but ultimately you have. One of the world's leading researchers in this to validate the performance.
I don't know, can I ask a question? Mm-hmm. Do you think that you could win an 8th Tour de France?
As I said earlier, I honestly don't know. I've been off the bike for 3.5 years. Come next summer, it'll be almost 4 years. With that is also the fact that I'll be nearly 38 years old at the start of the 2009 Tour de France, so I don't know. I will try to be as prepared as possible. I don't know that equals victory. In 2001, I could say that. I could say, yeah, I think I can win, or I want to win, or I'm going to win. I won't say that today because I simply don't know. And I'm not, I have a fair bit of confidence, but I don't have that kind of confidence yet, so. Oh, this is going to get hard. I've been over here the whole time. Let me go over here. Yes, sir.
I'm from VRChange.org, and I hear you up here speaking concerning preventable cancers, and it's a cause that's not championed much in today's mainstream media, and that is the plight of the first responders. Mm-hmm. Through September 11th. I was told that Eric Fowler was cleaned the breeze down there. I'm sure you're aware of that plight. I'd just like to know, is there anything that your organization is doing in conjunction with the Fielder Foundation or any other foundations who are trying to help the first responders? Mm-hmm. And also, if you stand with the family members, firemen and women, mm-hmm. and the first responders,
yep.
in calling for a reinvestigation into the terrorist attack.
Well, sir, I imagined a lot of questions today. I didn't imagine that one. I can tell you, we certainly stand with them. I didn't make a big deal about it, but I think it was on about September the 17th, 2001, I came to New York City and walked downtown and visited the firehouses and flew over Ground Zero with, at the time, Mayor Giuliani and former President Clinton. So I saw what that did to a community, and I had not had much exposure to New York City before that like I do now, but I certainly stand with them. And I certainly understand that there would be issues in the aftermath of something like that, environmental issues, toxic issues, health-related issues, and issues that it just boils down to fairness. When people put their lives on the line and they're willing to defend their community or their city or their state, you expect it to be reciprocated as well. But I don't know enough of the details to know. I would just reiterate that, obviously, having just celebrated the anniversary, we're all in tremendous support. And the interesting thing about that day was that everybody around the world, and you look around the room, and there's a lot of international press here, everybody in the world supported us that day. And I think that has probably changed since then. Yeah. No, I didn't say. Hang on. I saw some comments from Alberto yesterday that said he would perhaps leave. If there's something new, I didn't see it today. I think a couple things. You know, my main priority, as I've already said, is this global campaign. Number two, I think there's room for all of us on that team. Myself, Alberto, Levi, and Johan. Is quite the personality himself. And thirdly, as I've said many times over the last couple of years, I think, and as I think he just proved at the Vuelta, Alberto is the best rider on the planet right now. And so we have to understand that. We have to respect that. I'm not sure that I can ride that fast anymore. I certainly hope it works out. If he has other offers and he wants to go somewhere else or go to a Spanish team, perhaps that's his decision. But I would encourage him to give this situation an opportunity, and I would look forward to racing with him. Second part of your question, the Tour of Italy. I said I know where I'm going for a fact. I didn't say I want to go there, but I just haven't talked about it. It's an interesting year. A couple things. I never did the Tour of Italy. I would love to do it. This is the 100-year anniversary, which makes it significant for you guys and the Tifosi in Italy. And thirdly, I would encourage Mr. Berlusconi to enact some cancer-related legislation in the country. Italy is one of the countries that we focused on in our international study. It's one of the countries that came back and told us that we could have the most profound effect in terms of Livestrong. And so all of these things come together to make an interesting opportunity. I certainly wouldn't rule out the Tour of Italy of all. Angelo Zomignon, great friend of mine, old longtime friend of mine. And I like Italian food. Yeah.
Can you please say something about how you feel about the problems with doping in Latin? And are you trying to prove something about?
Yeah, important thing to understand is that doping isn't new. Doping has existed for almost as long as two guys lined up on a start line and there was a finish line. There's always been that incentive to try to perhaps cut the corner. And doping does not solely exist in cycling. Doping exists across all sports, across all facets of society. I've been very outspoken over the years that I think cycling does perhaps more, and I'd be willing to wager that we do more than any other sport when it comes to combating doping, and logically so, because we've had more issues. I think there's a mentality that we must have towards doping and towards catching cheaters. In my opinion and in my view, you have a sporting event like the Tour de France. You have the rules that are laid out. If people cross the line, you send them home, and you keep moving down the road. You don't sit around and cry. You don't say, we're going backwards 20 steps. We don't say the sport is finished. We don't say it's going to die. You keep moving. If they cross the line, they break the rules, they go home, we go forward. I think that's the fairest thing you can do for the riders. I think it's the fairest thing you can do for the fans. It's not a good thing. But I think ultimately, for the longevity of the sport and the health of the sport, you must move on. And so We feel like this program, and Don can speak to it better than I can, but I think this will be the most advanced anti-doping program in the world, you know, beyond anything else. I'm going to talk about it today. Beyond today, I'm not going to tell you how clean I am, and I'm not going to insinuate how dirty the others are. I'm going to ride my bike. I'm going to spread this message around the world, and Don Catlin can tell you if I'm clean or not. So I think that, too, is slightly detrimental.
Sir?
I don't even know where to go.
Arm
wrestling.
Right here.
You said you're 38 years old.
37. Just turned 37.
One of the greatest bikers ever. Is this just a one-time comeback if we win or lose the different tournaments, mm-hmm. as you mentioned?
Good question.
Are you looking to continue this? And
I don't want to box myself in here, so it's open-ended. I see, obviously, one season, but I wouldn't rule out a second season.
So you're taking what season by season?
Season by season. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Irene Keller. I report the British German Press. Your story is a magnificent global role model for a man with an iron will. So what is your secret? What gave you the strength, first of all, to beat a disease which is known to be deadly? And secondly, and then go on a bike and beat all the others and be champion.
Well, the only person missing, the person who can answer that question is not on this stage, and that's my mother. I think she instilled in me a certain drive, a certain motivation, even if I was a young kid playing sport or when I was diagnosed. She has a certain mentality that just says never quit. And so I think it's stuck with me so far today, and I suspect it'll stick with me for a long time. But I think it's just a resilience and a determination.
Right here.
Thank you. Thank you for what you're doing. I was born on the 8th of August 2000. The day that I gave up the fear of dying and embraced the joy of living without cancer. I was diagnosed with breast cancer that day, and so far, so good. But what I've done during that journey, it is a freedom that I never knew existed in life. And I've written an operetta on my journey through breast cancer, and I'm also writing a book called Healing from Cancer from the Inside Out. So I'd like to know, how can I help you?
Well, first and foremost, you just helped us because you stood up and you shared your story. And as Doug pointed out, there are millions of people around the world that live in a place or live in a society where they can't stand up and tell their story. They can't stand up and say, I have cancer, or here's what I'm going through, for fear of being discriminated against or ostracized or put away in a room. So it's a good thing that you and I can do that. And it's a good thing that I'll continue to do that, as will you, by writing a book. Me riding a bike, maybe writing a book, you writing a book. It's the simple power of a survivor standing up and just expressing that to the rest of the world and letting other people know that they're not alone. So I would encourage you to continue doing what you're doing. Obviously, things like books and other modes of outreach are hugely beneficial, and ultimately we'll get to a better place that we don't have to discuss it much anymore. Sure. Yeah, science there is just evolving. You talk about the water, the food, the air. You also talk about the ozone, sun exposure, especially down in Australia. These are all things because, as we just heard from Vice President Gore, climate change is a huge issue and is on the top of everybody's mind, second to the economy right now. But we have to research this. We have to understand that, obviously, we know lifestyle, and lifestyle choices play a huge role in cancer diagnoses, whether it's through diet or alcohol abuse or tobacco, lack of exercise. All of these things play a role, and I think that field is emerging, but you'll see these two come together. You'll see the debate on climate change and the debate on health care and disease come together and find some common ground.
Can you play a role in that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Sir? As often also the French radio Europe 1,
what would you do if the Tour de France company ASO bars you from passing dividend to the Tour de France? And is it true that as Vanity Fair that you can rely or ask Nicolas Sarkozy to help you in doing the Tour de France 2009?
Well, you know, listen, it's their event. They get to pick who's invited and who is not invited. So if I were to be not invited, there's not much I can do. However, I've won the event 7 times, and I know that there has been some controversy over some of those victories. I would ask and refer people to the independent commission that cleared up the issue of 1999. I would also remind you of the federal investigation in France in the year 2000 when all samples were retroactively tested and declared, I think the words were, pure as a driven snow. Beyond that, a lot of other books and articles and speculation, but I can't force myself on the event. It's their event, and I respect that. I will tell you that if Christian Prudhomme's comments stay true, he's said as long as we abide by the rules that everybody else abides by, which of course we will, plus some through Don, then we're welcome to come. And so I've relied on that. I've taken his word for it.
Any connection between the Global Summit with Nicolas Sarkozy and your participation
in
the Tour?
No. We would. If ASO said I cannot race the Tour, I might be speaking out of turn with my partner Doug, but I would assume that we would continue to do the Global Summit in Paris. Paris is a great city, and it's one of the hubs of Europe. Why wouldn't you do it there? I don't have any guarantees from President Sarkozy. I saw President Sarkozy last night, shook his hand, said hello, met his wife. Everybody wanted to know if you got to meet his wife, but I have no guarantees there. And so, again, I respect the event. I respect the organizers. I respect the Armory family. I think that Madame Armory is probably facing a critical time in the evolution of that corporation just on the way that the Tour has been handled in recent years. And you know, we look to be partners. We're not here to take anybody's fame, take anybody's glory. We're trying to be good partners and ride their event with dignity and honor. No, I read. Yeah, I've gotten a lot of questions about that. First of all, I don't have that kind of money. Second of all, it's very hard to believe that an American, not to mention a Texan, buys that event. But no, I'm not even aware that anybody's and talks to buy ASO or a percentage of ASO.
Last question.
Right.
What are your last questions?
Catherine, we could do a couple more, right? These people came from all over. Where to? Ladies first.
Yeah, hi. Janice Billingsley from HealthDay.com. And I just wanted to ask if you could address how you're achieving the balance between riding and the competition and the cancer initiative, of where you're going to be going and how... what your choices are, and if you're going to be working in countries before you decide to bike there,
yeah.
If they're going to do anything.
Absolutely. There'll be a lot of groundwork before.
And that's part of the way you're going to choose where to go?
Correct. And I would love to take all the credit, but I can only take – the only credit I can take is that my name is on the door and I'll be on the bike. There's a team of 70 people in Austin, Texas, working every day on this issue and trying to alleviate it. So beforehand, there'll be a lot of groundwork laid beforehand. When we go somewhere, we will know that we will have some progress or some sort of commitment. And it has to fit into the calendar. I mean, if you try to get to France in July, you know, you can't be doing a race in Beijing 2 days before. So it has to logically fit together.
Dan Friedel from USA Today. Did you, as a group, do any projections about what your impact would be if you went to some of these events that you haven't been to before? Because, I mean, your name is already a big name in the world in both cycling and in, you know, cancer prevention and research. What is kind of the end game here as far as the impact you're expecting to make with the comeback?
Yeah. Doug, did we have any, I mean, based on the studies we did, was there any firm data? Doug would be better to answer that. But, you know, based on the response we've had from organizers around the world, not just as organizers of bike races that say, please come. I mean, they understand that this is a dual mission. Yes, you're going to race your bike, but you're also going to try to bring about awareness in their community. So That's been part and parcel of their proposal whenever it comes across the email or the fax or the phone call. With that, I mean, if I look to, for example, if I look to Australia and I see it as a country that has a huge melanoma issue but has also done a lot of great work with regards to melanoma, I also see the budget at the Australian Cancer Institute is $120 million a year. $120 million a year for a fairly big country is pretty small. I have to think with Prime Minister Rudd and our collaboration, we can increase that. And, you know, time will tell. I mean, this is the kind of thing a year down the road, we may not be very successful at all, and we'll have to be honest and say we didn't do anything. I don't think that'll be the case. And at the end of a year, you know, at the summit in Paris, we'll be able to say, here's the commitments we've had from world leaders in different countries and continents, and here's what we plan to do with it.
How's that work? There's two of them.
Well, because we're both waiting.
Yes.
Basha Riddick, and I just wanted to say I think you're so awesome. And but I'm representing an organization called Pathways to Love and Healing, and I do a television show in Manhattan and around the country, around the world, in seven languages. And we're trying to be a voice for women in the grassroots that don't have medical coverage and have cancer and around the world. And I was just wondering, I'm sure you've taken that initiative, and if you have, how can I bring you to them? How can we
to the show?
Well, of course. But how can what initiatives are affecting them? The ones that don't have medical insurance, that don't have
here in the United States.
Yes, here in the United States and abroad.
Well.
But here, we can talk about the United States.
Well, right? Certainly. I mean, obviously, healthcare is. I mean, you have an election going, or campaigns, a couple campaigns going on, so you have all these things that people talk about. They talk about the economy, talk about terror, they talk about natural disaster, they talk about healthcare, education, et cetera. I think we'll see the face of healthcare change regardless of who wins this election, and certainly could change more if certain parties won or not. But healthcare reform is essential, I think, in the United States today, regardless of, again, who wins. But this will have a drastic impact on people that need it the most. As I talked about in my speech up there before, visiting Harlem, spending time with Dr. Freeman, I understand the sensitivity around not having insurance or not having the proper insurance or not being able to speak the proper language or not being able to understand a system that's so complicated that nobody in this room can understand it. So we have to address all those. Yeah, I think it depends where you are. I mean, if you compare the United States to South America or to Africa, you have a whole another list, totally different list of issues. I mean, you could look at, or even you could compare Africa with Asia. Asia has a huge tobacco-related problem. Africa does not because they don't have tobacco. But they have an issue of access to care and diagnosis and screening and vaccinations. And so it changes and evolves depending on where you travel around the world. But the records will show, and the facts are the facts, that 8 million people will die this year to this disease. It's a monumental number. A lot of things shock me. I mean, I think big tobacco and its abuses shock me. I think that, I tell you what shocks me. I think in 20 years we'll look back on chemotherapy and that will shock us. We'll look at that and say, I can't believe we did that to fellow human beings.
All right, thank you. Thanks, everyone.